My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how to get comfortable with fear and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern.
People say, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of fear because it's like I want to confront anything in my life that feels challenging on those levels.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Math and Magic, a production of iHeartRadio.
I didn't really think about it as a business at first. And then eventually when we put it up on a bit of a lark, we started to see people calling and suddenly we were getting, you have 27 calls this hour. And then later I would call and say, you have 142,000 calls this hour. Like that started happening and we were amazed by it.
Hi, I'm Bob Pittman and welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. On our episode today, we're going to hear some lessons and stories from a man whose life has been about curiosity and the unique skills to turn that curiosity into businesses and projects and have fun along the way. Entrepreneur, filmmaker, Andrew Jarecki. Andrew grew up in the New York City suburbs in the 60s and 70s, wildly successful and very curious parents with an incredible work ethic, a family of high achievers. He started one of those businesses everyone used in the 1990s, Movie Phone. I was at AOL when we bought it, and although I knew Andrew before then, I got to know him a lot better after that. He co-wrote a theme song for a hit TV show, directed a movie with Ryan Gosling, made a documentary that won 18 international prizes and was nominated for an Academy Award. He produced the movie Catfish and the HBO series The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst, which led to his arrest and prosecution. He's a fascinating blend between street culture and the Ivy League. He's really funny, equally as nice, and he also plays drums. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you.
So before we jump into the meaty stuff, I want to do you in 60 seconds. You ready?
Perfect.
Do you prefer cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Early riser or night owl?
Night owl.
New York or Los Angeles?
New York.
Coke or Pepsi?
Iced tea.
Beach or mountains?
Beach.
Beatles or Stones?
Everything is the Beatles.
Books or movies?
Movies.
Cook or eat out?
Eat out.
Comedy or drama?
Comedy.
It's about to get harder. First job?
I was a magician.
All-time favorite musical artist?
Stevie Wonder.
Favorite TV show?
The Bear.
Smartest person you know?
My dad.
Childhood hero?
Willy Wonka.
Favorite movie?
Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Technology, you can't live without it.
I have a snow cone machine. I cannot live without that.
Most important bit of advice you ever got?
From my dad. Don't just do something, stand there.
Favorite city?
Rome.
Secret talent?
I was Duncan Yo-Yo champion in 1973.
Have you lost the skill?
Kind of.
Okay, final one. What did you want to be when you were growing up?
I think I wanted to be a filmmaker.
Let's start with Movie Phone. It was pre and early internet. It was a way to get movie listings for people who are young and don't understand movie phone. Everybody used it. That's where you got the info about what movie was out. You could buy your tickets there. And those were in the days when you talked into a phone to get stuff done as opposed to going on the internet. And everyone really knew the voice of Mr. Movie Phone. Give us the origin story.
I was trying to go to the movies around 1988, and I was calling my local theater, which you used to have to do because the New York Times didn't have all the showtimes in it. The theater phone lines were always busy because the theaters didn't understand that there were 2,000 people trying to call in a 20-minute period for that night. And I got through at 8:15, and the machine told me that the movie had started at 8 o'clock. And I thought, why did I just ruin my night? And this multi-billion-dollar movie industry doesn't get that I'm not able to go out and buy my $7 then movie ticket. So I thought, you know, voicemail was pretty advanced then. And I thought, why don't we create a service that lets you push buttons? Maybe it's a free local service. And you put in the first three letters of the movie title, put in your zip code, and it would spit out just the theater closest to you, just the information that you needed. I thought that would be a cool thing for me to use. I didn't really think about it as a business at first. And then eventually when we put it up on a bit of a lark, we started to see people calling, and suddenly we were getting, you have 27 calls this hour. And then later I would call and say, you have 142,000 calls this hour. Like, that started happening and we were amazed by it.
And so that's the idea. You get it started. How did you know how to turn that into a business? Remember, we were on the buying end of it. You sold it for a lot of money.
It's true. And, you know, I was very lucky because my dad is a very smart business person. And, you know, he started out as a psychiatrist. He was a professor of psychiatry at Yale, but he always had a business bug. He was so smart about business. So I think I immediately thought, well, this thing that we just put together seems to be working for consumers. I wonder how much I can promote it. I wonder how I can promote it. I talked to my dad about it. I talked to other smart people that I knew. It was pretty clear that all of our customers were walking through the doors of about 5,000 cinemas in America. So if I could get the number 777 film in front of people up on the screens and trailers before the movie, I also figured out everybody's motivations quickly. I went to a bunch of conventions, Show East and Show West. I didn't know anybody. And I just walked around and talked to everybody.
This is the movie business.
In the movie business. Right. And I realized that nobody was talking to each other. They didn't understand that moviegoers were having trouble going to the movies. It was just a pain in the neck to do it. And the studios didn't really control the theaters. The theaters didn't control the studios. And I thought, well, there's a window in here where I could make things easier for the consumer and also make something that would be very useful for the industry. So we just started to figure out where are the little pinch points and leverage points. So, for example, I knew that the theater owners had control over their movie screens. At the time, nobody was doing advertising on movie screens. So I said to the theater owners, if I give you a 30-second ad for Movie Phone and it's entertaining, will you put it up on their screens? Knowing that they had a problem, which was that the newspapers were charging them a fortune to put their movie listings in the newspapers. The studios weren't helping them. So they said, well, if this guy's coming along, he's going to do it for free. I'll give him 30 seconds of free time before the movie. So that was an example of some marketing thinking that helped us tremendously. And it was a very, you know, what do they say? All marketing is local, you know, getting out into the movie theaters, handing out little cards to people, getting that message up on the screen. It sort of flowed naturally.
And where did Mr. Movie Phone come from? The voice.
Very interesting. The voice was very important. And if you call right now, you can't really hear it anywhere. But if you call my wife's cell phone, you'll hear, hello and welcome to Nancy Phone. It became really important to the brand. And it was lucky because when I started the company in 88, 89, I found that there were a couple guys in Los Angeles who were doing the exact same thing that we were. We saw a little blurb about them in the Hollywood Reporter. We called them up on the phone and I said, well, I'd like to speak to the president, please. And the guy said, speaking. And I thought, well, that's good. This is a tiny little company. And so we decided to join forces. And he was the voice. And he was a guy from Idaho with a mustard-colored suit and big shoulder pads. And he had a big hairstyle. And he was nothing like me. You know, I'd gone to school on the East Coast and grown up in a totally different way. But we had been working on the same idea quietly for a long time. And I learned, by the way, later from him that not only was he the voice of Movie Phone and a very recognizable voice, but that his mother in Idaho was the time lady. She was the person you would call and she would say, at the tone, the time will be 11:45 exactly. Boop. I thought that was kind of incredible.
Genetic.
It's genetic.
So why did you decide to sell the business?
I had been doing it for around, I think, 11 years. And then I ran into you. I went to the premiere of You've Got Mail, which is a movie that featured AOL. And it also had a little Movie Phone blurb in it. It was Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan are walking around and you hear the hello and welcome to Movie Phone. And I was sitting right in front of you and the whole AOL team was there. And I got up and you said to me, how are you doing? And I said, good. And he said, what's going on with your business? And I had just been in these conversations and I didn't know where the conversations were going. I had a friend who was a banker and my friend said to me, what's going on? And I said, well, I'm talking to this Barry Diller about this thing. And I'm talking to this other guy about this thing. And he said, oh, you're selling your company. And I said, no, you don't understand. I'm going to do a strategic alliance with somebody. And he said, Andrew, I've been doing this a long time. You're selling your company. And then you said, well, you know, but come visit me. And then I had a phone call with you and you said, listen, I'd love to see you. But if you're going to come, just to let you know, like big companies don't do strategic alliances with little tiny companies. Like we just buy those companies. So if that's on the radar for you, if that's something that's possible, then we should get together. And I thought, maybe that's right. Maybe that is how this is going to end up playing out. So we started moving forward.
This was your first big win, probably financially and probably image-wise and accomplishment. How did it change your own self-image?
You know, it's a boost because you feel like this thing that you've been laboring over in the shadows has been noticed. It was clear to me also that it was going to be a fun process, that I was going to learn something. I was going to learn something from you. I was going to learn something from the people on the deal. It was a new chapter to think about taking this thing and bringing it into another company.
You and I became pretty good pals after the AOL days. And you always had a good story about something. And I remember you said, you know, I'm thinking about how I'm going to make a documentary about the clowns for kids' parties. Then the next time I saw you and ask you how that film was coming along, you said, well, it had taken a strange and unexpected turn. Can you tell us the story of Capturing the Friedmans, which, by the way, was nominated for an Academy Award and won Sundance and a bunch of other awards?
It was a very strange ride and a wonderful ride in a lot of ways. Because as I said, I was a magician when I was 12 years old. I could charge $35 and I could go to people's houses and entertain their children at the birthday party. I had moved on and stopped doing that when I was 12. Yet these people were always in my mind because they were interesting characters. You know, they call each other by their clown names in real life. And Silly Billy is best friends with Princess Priscilla. And when they have issues in their relationship, they go to Professor Putter. And I thought, this is a crazy, amazing community. I bet there's a lot of humanity there. I bet if I go talk to these people, I'll find an interesting story. So I reached out to many of them and ultimately settled on this guy, Silly Billy, who was the number one guy in New York.
And I remember Silly Billy from my kids.
Yeah. And if it was a fancy Park Avenue family, if you didn't hire Silly Billy, you were not keeping up with the rest of the people on Park Avenue. And I remember I kind of held off on talking to him because I knew that he had a big ego. And I thought if I called him right off the bat, he would torture me. So I waited until I talked to everybody else, all of his competitors. And finally, I called him and I said, you know, I'm making this film. And he says, well, it's not much of a film without me in it. And I said, okay, well, you know, fair enough. You know, do you want to participate? Well, yeah, okay, come on over. So I started to interview him. And ultimately, I discovered that he had a secret story and that his sort of clown persona was something that he had been living under for all these years. And I never thought there was anything sinister about him, but I learned very quickly that his family had been the target of a massive criminal case where they had been accused of what at the time was called a mass sex abuse case, that they'd been accused of molesting hundreds of children. And I thought, well, this is an incredibly deep and complicated situation where you have somebody who's New York's number one children's entertainer, and his family is one of the most notorious families in the history of New York. And then as I got deeper into it, I found out there was a lot more to the story. And in fact, it wasn't what I thought when I first looked into it. And I went back to him and I said, you've sort of hinted things to me just to let you know. I did figure it out. And eventually he said to me, well, if that's what you're making a movie about, I don't know how I feel about that, but I probably should tell you that when my family was the subject of this big criminal investigation, the police came and knocked down the door of our house in Great Neck, Long Island. I had just bought a video camera and I started recording the family falling apart. And that was one of the most unique pieces of video. There were about 22 hours of the most intimate, most upsetting internal family discussions. And they really traced what was happening to the family. And that became a really important part of the film. So the film shifted tremendously from what I originally thought to what it became.
You ever feel guilty about having that insider access? I mean, what kind of emotions come up because suddenly you're right in the middle of it?
Yeah, I mean, I found myself in that situation a lot. I think that I come to it with an open heart. I try to be fair to people. In that case, it was up to Silly Billy, it was up to David Friedman to decide whether to let me use that material. There was a multi-month period when he had shown me the material. I knew how powerful it was, and he had not yet decided whether he was going to give it to me or not.
What lesson did you learn about product creation with this film? I mean, we all talk in business about pivots. That's a hell of a pivot.
I think the most important thing for me is always just to try to follow my intuition. There were many times when I noticed little things about the story and they made me curious and I tried to stay open and I tried to be a good listener because people really do want to tell you their story. I remember Al Maisels, the great documentary filmmaker, said to me when I was in the middle of capturing the Friedmans, and I was worried that I was going to expose this family in a way, and they had already been very traumatized. You know, whatever you thought about them, they had really been very damaged by it. And he said, nobody wants to die without telling their story. You're doing them a favor and you're going to do it with fairness and with love.
Catfish, the movie. It's also a TV show. How about that one? Give us the origin there. And here you are dealing with the unexpected again.
This is a very strange way that you and I cross paths again, because that would never have happened if it weren't for you guys. I was in Los Angeles working on a film, and Nancy said to me, you know, the Pittmans are calling and they sent you this thing and there's this DVD. And I remember thinking, oh, right, I got that DVD. I promised that I would watch it. So I just started watching it at about midnight and I couldn't take my eyes off this footage. And it wasn't yet a film, but it was the beginnings of something. And it was a story about a guy, Neeb Shulman, who was a friend of yours, and his brother and their friend, and how this 8-year-old girl had sent Neve a Facebook message saying, hey, I'm only 8, but I'm a painter. I saw one of your photographs and I'd like to do a painting of it. Would you mind? Neve said, okay, you can do it. And she did this painting. And a few months later, she sends him the painting and it's quite good, perhaps, you know, curiously, strangely good for an 8-year-old. And they get into a conversation with her mother and the filmmakers start filming it. And they meet not just her mother, but also her sister, who's 19, and a whole constellation of other people in this little girl's life. And at some point, it becomes clear that maybe the story is not as innocent as we thought. And then the boys go on a road trip out to Ishpeming, Michigan, to discover what's really going on and what's really behind this 8-year-old painter. The story was so gripping when I was watching it, and it wasn't even together yet. And I remember thinking, I can help, and we can help bring this thing to the screen in a more substantial way. And we agreed to work together on it. And then it was a Sundance, and then it was a big hit, and then it turned into this television show. But it's another one of those stories that you think is going one way and then goes a very different way.
Okay, I'm going to do one last one, and then we'll get to some other topics.
Sure.
Robert Durst. Talk about a strange twist and turn. I remember you made the scripted movie about him and how he probably murdered his wife. And then he calls you and things pivot.
Big pivot.
Tell us about it.
So I had been interested in the story of Bob Durst, who had been suspected of killing 3 people but never convicted. And in fact, never really even tried for anything other than one of them. And he had been acquitted. And I thought that what was perhaps most interesting about it was that he had this beautiful wife, and in 1982, she disappeared, and nobody knew what happened to her, and a lot of people suspected him of killing her. So I started writing a screenplay about that story and reached out to Bob Durst through his lawyer. And his lawyer said, oh, Bob's a very private guy and, you know, he wishes you well, but he doesn't want to participate or help you with your script. And I said, okay. And then we finished the film, and there had been a little speculation while we were making the film that while I was with Ryan Gosling and Kirsten Dunst in Westchester shooting at a train station and so on.
The scripted film.
The scripted right. film. That somebody had been kind of spying on us, that somebody was off in the bushes or somebody was in a car nearby. And I thought, well, that's crazy. But ultimately, I learned that that was true. And so the guy who had been so curious about it was Bob Durst.
How old was he at this time?
He was in his late 60s. And so he had reached out through the distributor of the film, Magnolia Pictures. Just one day, he called up Eamon Bowles, the guy who was the head of the company. And we used to do this thing where I would use Bob's voice because he has a very recognizable voice. So we would just joke around like that. And I would, when I was hanging up on the phone,
let's hear the voice.
I would say, if I was finishing the call, I would say, bye-bye, which is how Bob says goodbye and other things like that. And so one day, Eamon gets a phone call and the assistant comes in and in air quotes says, you know, it's Bob Durst on the phone. And he picks up the phone, assuming it's me. And he says, oh, Bob, I'm glad you're calling. And the guy on the phone says, who am I talking to? And Eamon says, oh, this is Eamon Bowles. Who is this? This is Robert Durst. So Eamon was very, very nervous about this. And he called me and he said, listen, Bob Durst wants to get in touch with you. And he put us in touch. And because I had Bob's cell phone number, because he had made the first call, I was able to record the first call I ever made to him. He and I started talking and he said, well, you know, I want to see the movie. I've heard good things about the movie. I said, great. I want to show it to you. I went out to LA. I showed it to him in a screening room. He called me right after he saw it. And he said, I want you to know I like the movie very much. And let's talk about doing something together. We started talking about maybe doing an interview. And finally, I did sit down with him for 3 days in California and interviewed him about all these subjects.
Now, did you have a camera rolling when you...
Oh, yeah. We had 3 cameras because I knew it was so unusual that somebody was in his position and would be willing to talk about and be asked questions about these 3 murders. And his position was, I didn't do any of these murders. But I thought, well, he probably did. And I'm fascinated to see how he's going to describe these things to me. So we did these 3 days of interviews. And then it became clear to me that it was going to require a reinvestigation of the case, that I might be able to find things that the police hadn't found. And then, in fact, we did. And we discovered a piece of evidence that tied him to the murders.
Like true crime podcasts before their time.
Yeah.
You solved the murder.
Yeah. It was a very unusual situation. And it was really the first or among the very first times that HBO or a broadcaster like that had decided it was okay to do a 6-part documentary series because there was so much gripping material in it. There was no way to do it as just a film. So it ended up being this sort of behemoth. And then what's unique about it is that in the last episode, he confesses. And he confesses in a very unusual way.
Accidentally
on a hot mic in the bathroom. Because I think he was so burdened by this information. And I think he did in his own way feel guilty and feel that he had killed the person that probably loved him most in the world, his wife. And so when I finish the conversation and I show him the evidence, he goes in the bathroom seconds later and he says, there it is, you're caught. And then a few minutes later, he's rambling because he does talk to himself and he's rambling in the bathroom and he says, I killed them all, of course. And that became headline news. It was literally in the front page of the New York Times, I think 3 times in a row, this story. And he was arrested the day before the final episode aired on HBO. That's never happened.
And he was preparing to leave the country, correct?
He was getting ready to go to Cuba.
You went through a long period with Durst in your life.
18 years.
How did your family react sharing you with that obsession?
Well, I remember the last episode was sort of in the offing, and Bob knew for a period of time that the show was going to be very bad for him. In the beginning, I think he thought, well, this will be fun. It'll be the me show. I can say whatever I want and they'll just film it and it'll go on television. So for him, I think there was a you know, there was just a narcissistic thrill to it. But as it was clear to him that I had found this evidence, and as I showed him the evidence, he started to get more and more anxious about it. And then my family started to get more anxious about him knowing that because he hadn't been arrested. And at one point, the FBI was trailing him, and I had an FBI agent that I was talking to all the time. And then one day he called me up. He said, yeah, we lost him. And so that morning, I think I got a security detail, and I remember meeting with my daughter the night before. We were having dinner, and I said, she was little at the time, and I said to her, just so you know, tomorrow we're going to have some other people with us when we go take you to school. And she immediately started crying. So she knew that it was an unusual time.
More of Math and Magic right after this quick break.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
More Than a Movie is back with season 2 of the award-winning film podcast, and this time with a lot more movies. I'm your host, Alex Fumero, and each week I'm going to talk to the people behind some of my favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the OG spy kid, Alexa Penavega.
You had Carlo Gugino, who's the coolest mom ever. You had Antonio, who's handsome, amazing, charismatic. And then Carmen and Juni. I felt like a lot of other kids felt like this could be me.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Every episode will feature interviews with the biggest actors, directors, writers, and producers behind your favorite films and tap into the history of Latinos in film. Listen to More Than a Movie as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Math and Magic. Let's hear more from my conversation with Andrew Jarecki.
So let's go back in time. I want to explore your origins. You were a kid of the 60s, 70s, and I guess early 80s. Tell me about your family and describe how that moment in time, that family shaped you.
We went from, when I was little, living in New Haven, when my dad was at Yale, and my mom was, she was a writer and eventually became a writer at Time Magazine. And the two of them were very important influences because my dad was very scientific and methodical and became even more so in a way when he went into business because he's very numerate. And so to some extent, my dad was the math and my mom was the magic. And I think that I always listened to both of them and I always had both of those voices in my ear. And then we moved to New York because my dad was starting a business that was going to grow to be a big business. My mom was a big influence. And I think my mom, because she had actually been a film critic at Time Magazine, my mom thought about films and she showed me films and we talked about artistic things. My dad does not read fiction, doesn't get it, doesn't understand why people read fiction. But those two pieces, I think, were very important in giving me permission to be interested in both, to be okay with math and to understand the benefit of business, but also to listen to my artistic side.
What did you learn in childhood that you still use today?
I mean, one thing is that, you know, my dad was tough and not always predictable. And he was in that those early years, very mercurial. You never quite knew what you were going to get out of him. My dad was a genius. When he was in Germany as a child, they used to test out the IQ tests on him, and he scored a 206. And so when I was a kid, we would sit at the dinner table with him and say, okay, Dad, 15,647 divided by 142,930. And he would get like a dopey look on his face, and he would say, 5.6973. And I thought, okay, well, that's what I got here. I got a brilliant guy who's not always going to be predictable. I got good at dealing with complicated personalities. And Bob Durst is an example of one. Dilly Billy is an example of one. It's something that kind of became a little bit of a superpower.
You went to Princeton. When you were there, you directed theater, right?
Yeah.
You were clearly going on a path. Why did you veer off into business after college? Why not continue with the creative bent?
When I was in college, I had been doing a lot of theater stuff. I had been reading a lot of theater. I pursued it intellectually, but also directed plays and produced plays. And interestingly, my senior thesis production, which was a production of a play called Ubu, not only had I done this sort of whole artistic thing, but I decided that I wanted to do a marketing campaign for it that would be like for a movie. And so I had everybody on campus wearing these little buttons that said Ubu. Nobody knew what it was. And we ended up having a sold out run for the entire run. And that never happens, you know? So my dad saw that happening. And I had a professor at Princeton who said, I want you to go to Yale Drama School for directing because that's going to be your thing. And I said that to my dad. And I think he decided he was going to lobby against it. And we had dinner together and he said, listen, we have this big business. It's an incredible learning experience. I get that you want to do the artistic thing, but I want you to come into business for a year or two. Once you learn what a treasury bill is and once you understand something about how you talk to a lawyer, then even if you decide to be an artist, you're not going to get screwed like all the other artists you know. And it was a pretty compelling argument. He was selling the biggest of his businesses at that time. There was a guy that was running it who was brilliant. And he said, come work for George and you don't have to deal with me at all, but this guy's going to take you to business school. I put the artistic stuff on hold really because my dad thought it was a good idea. And I thought I would listen to him. As it turned out, I think it really was an enormously important choice because I was able to go back to artistic work after that, but with a completely different set of tools.
At one point in your life, you just picked up and moved to Rome for a while. Kids, everything. What was that about?
You know, I had sold the business. Thanks to you, I was able to go do something completely different. And I remember thinking, you know, my kids go to private school in Manhattan. And Nancy and I were thinking, like, we got to get them out of here and just get them into a place where they're going to have a new language and a new frame of reference. And so we moved to Rome originally for a year. And you said to me, don't move for 2 years. And I said, why not? And you said, well, 1 year is great, but 2 years, people stop inviting you to things. You're off the radar. And I remember thinking, like, he might be right, but let me see how I feel after a year. And we ended up staying for 2 years. But it changed a lot of things in my brain. I forced myself to really learn Italian because I wanted to see the world for a period of time from a different perspective. It was hugely helpful. It was the smartest thing we ever did, was just to mix it up like that and to get into a community where we had never met anybody before, an apartment that we had never lived in before, a city that we didn't know. It was really powerful.
Let's hit some topics. The creative process. How do you take an idea and to turn it into something tangible, whether that's a business, a movie, or a TV show?
I think the most important thing is that you don't know where anything's going. So I always say, like, you can't see the inside of the house from the front lawn. You have to get into the foyer in order to peek in and see the dining room and the living room. So you got to do something first. You got to go try something. If I want to make a movie about birthday party clowns, I got to go around myself and pick up parenting magazines and go look in the back and see where the magician ads are. There's no version of it where you can just imagine your way into it. So I think that's such an important thing with movie phones, starting by putting up a phone service and seeing whether anybody would call it and just telling hundreds of people instead of millions of people and seeing whether it picked up. So the working model, being able to get something on its feet, that I think is really important. Just getting your feet wet and feeling okay about not knowing where it's going, not getting panicky about that. Just saying, yeah, I don't know. I'm writing this essay. I don't know what the end's going to be. I'm just going to keep chiseling away at it.
Corporate culture. You built one at Movie Phone, and I suspect on all of your movies, TV shows, you also have a culture of that group. What does the culture do for you? How do you build it? How do you use it?
I always say in the very beginning, something in the first group meeting or whatever that lets people know two things. One is, I have an idea of where we're going, but I don't know where we're going. And the reason I'm hiring the best people, and you guys are all distinguished, incredible, talented people, is because I really want to hear from you. I would say 10% of the people take that seriously. 90% of the people still sit quietly meeting after meeting. And it's always an effort to figure out who are the 10Xers, the people we used to talk about at AOL. Who are the people that are just head and shoulders bigger contributors, and nurture those people. You go in that first meeting and you want everybody to contribute. And pretty quickly you realize a lot of people are just too shy to do it. And every once in a while you get a really shy person who's also brilliant. And that person, if you can access them, that's a lunch that you want to keep having or whatever. A big part of it is just figuring out where is the talent? Where are the people that are going to bring you these ideas that are going to make your thing work? Because you're not going to be able to do it on your own.
We couldn't have a conversation without mentioning two letters, AI. What's it going to do to the movie and TV business and making the product?
I'll tell you what I'm seeing right now, and it's fascinating, is we're using AI every day in making a documentary. We're making the part two of The Jinx right now, and it's an enormous production and hundreds of subjects that are being interviewed. I would never use AI in a finished film. I would never say, oh, Bob Pittman just did an interview and I made him say something he didn't say. Obviously, that would be a total breach of everything. But if I do a 3-hour interview with you and you say everything except for the one remark I need you to say to conclude your thing, I can take your voice and make you say it. And then when I'm watching the rough cut, there you are and you're saying it. If I want to use it, I will come back to you and I'll say, hey, is this something that you feel comfortable saying, or say it in your own words? So right now, there are AI lines that are going into that film that will never make it into the final film. But the fact that I can have them in the rough cut means I can move much faster in making the film. That's the big ethical consideration. There's no question that there's a filmmaker sitting there right now who's saying, well, I wish I could get Donald Trump to say this thing, or I wish I could get Joe Biden to say this thing. And they'll probably use it, right? We're seeing that already. We're seeing deep fakes and we're seeing people saying things that they didn't say. So that's the line, is how do you make sure that you're doing it ethically, but that you're using it for the incredible acceleration that it lets you get.
Let's go to some advice. For someone who dreams of being a filmmaker, what advice can you give them?
I would say, especially today, the technology is no longer an impediment, right? In olden days, you used to have to say, well, I'm going to have to buy this camera and I want to buy some film and I need 9 people to do it. You don't really need that. There's stuff in The Jinx in this next season that's coming out that was shot on this iPhone. And you can't shoot a whole movie in an extremely cheap way, but you can do a lot of experimentation and you can figure out whether you have something or not. So I would say, same thing, get your feet wet. You know, you got to just go and try the first thing. You may get it wrong. You may throw it in the trash, but you're going to learn something.
So for the major studios, you're on the front lines. You always spend a lot of time on the cutting edge, what's new. What advice can you give them from that perspective?
oh, it's so hard, right? Because they make such enormous mistakes all the time. They always have. They're trying to do the best they can. My friend was telling me the story of, you know, Titanic was at Fox, and it was this like incredible investment. They were $200 million into it. Nobody had ever made a film like that before. And Rupert or whoever said, well, we got to lay this thing off. This is going to be a disaster. It's probably going to go down like the Titanic. They sell 50% of it. And then, of course, the movie makes $1 billion. And everybody is like, who's getting fired for this terribly stupid decision? So whenever they're big bets like that, it's incredibly hard to predict anything. I'm amazed that they do it and keep their jobs. The thing I guess I would say is they got to hire a lot of kids. They got to surround themselves with people that are younger than studio executives, just because that's where the ideas are. You want to welcome those people. You don't want to make it hard for them to climb up the ranks.
So if you could go back in time, what advice would you give your 21-year-old self?
I think I was hard on myself. I think I was beating myself with a big switch all the time. And I think, you know, that you give yourself a lot of scars by doing that. But it's not easy to have a successful business, and you sort of feel like you have to be your own taskmaster. Everything seems urgent. Everything's so critical. Could I have thought differently about it at 21? I don't know. But I guess I would say, you know, I'd maybe be nicer to me.
So we end each episode of Math and Magic with a shout out to the best on both ends of the spectrum of business and marketing. The best at the analytics, science and math, your dad. The best at sheer creative, promotions, etc. Who gets your shout out for each?
The thing I think is so special about my dad is that on the business side, is that he really has no orthodoxy. If you walk in and you say, you know, we should buy this company because blah, 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 he'll say, well, what if we just sold the company? Like, he just flips it all the time. On the marketing side, I think it's the improvisational people. There's a guy that I love, a guy named Deacon Webster, who was the head of a creative at a advertising agency called Mad Dogs and Englishmen. He still runs his own agency in New York. And whenever I'm needing to figure out how to make something cool or how to get it in front of more people, I usually just call him up and I try to have lunch with him. And he's worked on a lot of stuff with me. So I like his ability to just think freely. Certainly on the marketing side, that's so important because freshness is everything. You know, it's so important for somebody to see something that is not predictable. And I think it draws people in. So those creative people that are willing to think outside the box are really precious.
Andrew, you have always been one of the most curious people I know. You're blessed with being, as we see today, a fascinating storyteller as well. You've managed to put both of those together to have a wonderfully successful business life too, as well as personal life. Thanks for sharing your stories and insights today about how you did it and what you learned. Here are a few things I picked up from my conversation with Andrew. One, plan on pivoting. As Andrew says, you can't see the inside of the house from the front lawn. Starting a project with an open mind and allowing it to evolve can ensure you end up with the best possible outcome. Two, sometimes collaboration beats competition. Instead of trying to beat out another company with the same model as MoviePhone, they combined efforts for a huge payoff. Andrew's documentary work tells a similar story. Close relationships with his subjects have made his work all that more compelling. Collaboration can take on many forms, and you may wind up working with someone you never expected to, and the rewards may be bigger than you ever anticipated to. Three, embrace changing technology. Andrew may not use AI in the final cut of his films, but that doesn't mean it's not an asset during production. AI can be used to accelerate projects and make workflow more seamless. Leaning into innovative tech doesn't have to mean compromising the integrity of your work or even turning it upside down. Embracing new tools for innovation can allow you to do the work you excel at just more efficiently. I'm Bob Pittman. Thanks for listening.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks so much for listening to Math and Magic, a production of iHeart Podcasts. The show is hosted by Bob Pittman. Special thanks to Sydney Rosenblum for booking and wrangling our wonderful talent, which is no small feat. Math and Magic's producers are Emily Marinoff and Jessica Krymchich. It is mixed and mastered by Bahid Frazier. Our executive producers are Nikki Etor and Ali Perry. And of course, a big thanks to Gail, Raul, Eric, Angel, Noel, and everyone who helped bring this show to your ears. Until next time.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how to get comfortable with fear and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern.
People say, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of fear because it's like I want to confront anything in my life that feels challenging on those levels.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today. Listen to Rappaport's Reality starting May 8th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.